You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked, if movies have women in them, are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hey, Jamie.
Yes, Caitlin.
I made some barbecue, and also a man might be missing, but the two things have nothing to do with each other. Do you want some of my barbecue that I made?
I'm going vegan. Is it vegan?
It's,
is there a reason it wouldn't be vegan?
Well, barbecue tends to have animal byproducts.
Okay, you know what? You sold me. I'll try it.
Okay, you're going to love it. It's the tastiest barbecue you've ever had.
Wow. It's a little tough. This has been a fun role play. We could have just kept going with this.
And why don't
scene.
We?
What an episode we have for you today. This is the Bechdel test. No. Oh my God. I sound like people who are reviewing us who haven't actually listened to the show. They're like, it's the Bechdel test?
The Bechdel test podcast, right? That's what it's called?
I'm a huge fan. It's the Bechdel test? You're just like, oh, you're a liar. Okay. How polite. Southern politeness. This is our show where we use the Bechdel test as a jumping off point for discussion to have an intersectional conversation about some of your favorite movies in the entire world.
Truly.
Yes.
Well, what on earth is the Bechdel test, though?
Well, if you don't know what the Bechdel test is, does that ever happen to you, Caitlin? Like, I feel like that has happened to me many times.
Where people don't know and I have to explain it?
No, that they're pretending to know, but they're calling it the Bechdel test over and over and over, and it's very clear that they haven't listened to the show, which is fine. Just say that.
For the name of the podcast? Yeah.
Yeah,
all the time.
I'm a huge fan.
We've been guests on other people's podcasts where they're like, she's the host of the Bechdel podcast.
Yes. Or
they're like not wrong, but it's not right.
The best one is when we did a show in London, Bragg, remember going places? And they put out a marquee that said the Women in Film podcast. And we're like, well, this is, again, it's not incorrect, but it's weird to list a theme instead of a title.
Right.
In any case, the Bechdel test is a media metric invented by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test, that requires the following for our purposes. There's many permutations of this, but for us, we need two non-male characters to speak to each other. They also have to have names. I'd like to go back. They speak to each other about something other than a male character for two lines of dialogue. Does it usually happen in movies? No.
Not a lot.
Today? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my other favorite mistake that people make when they explain my podcast to me is that they say, oh, yeah, you and Caitlin talk about whether a movie passes the Bechdel test for 2 hours. I'm like, what would that conversation be like? I don't know.
We go through every single minute of the movie and be like, well, did that exchange pass? Yeah. Yes? No? Okay, let's move on to the next line of dialogue.
Anyone have any observations on this? No? Okay, let's move on. What if we just did that for all of Indiana Jones and we're just like, okay, minute 75. No women. No women. Let's move on.
No women in that.
Only men. Yep. Only men.
What about just like a taboo buzzer? Just like, eh, you know? I thought it was mostly buzzer. That's what I thought the podcast was. Just dings and buzzers?
Oh, yeah.
We should have been implementing that from day one. I don't know why we didn't think of that.
But we're talking about fried green tomatoes today.
And the voice you just heard is that of comedian, journalist, host of News Broke on AJ Plus, host of the Bituation Room podcast. It's Francesca Fiorentini.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome.
Man, I'm so excited to talk about this film.
Thanks for being here. We're psyched.
Thank you for having me.
It's a treat. And thank you for bringing this movie, too. This has been a fairly popular request. It's been requested to us many times over the years. And it's the day.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about Fried Green Tomatoes. What is your history with this movie?
Okay, so I watched this when it came out. So in 91, and I was like 11, 10, around then. But kind of like, yes, I miss some of the jokes around like women examining their own vaginas. And like marital stuff, you know, it was me just like looking at my teddy bear like, totally. You know, like what am I didn't really get that. But I definitely understood how moving, how important this film was, what it meant about female friendship, how men are trash.
Have you read the book? Has anyone read the book?
We
have not read the book.
I have not read the book. But I have read a lot about the book. There is a lot of really, really interesting, complicated context between the book and the film. And I love a good adaptation discussion. That said, I have not read the book.
Shit, I wish I had.
Cool, we're all in the same boat. But yes, we have a fair amount of context about the book.
Oh,
that
my document is horrifying this week. Caitlin,
Jamie, what's your...
Oh, we're so Southern polite. We're Kathy
You're
Bates.
So polite.
No, after you.
Oh, thank you. Uh-huh. I saw it for the first time. It was one of those movies that as a young film student in college, I was like, this is an important movie. I need to see it. I need to have seen it in my life. I watched it once as a freshman in college, I want to say. It was one of those ones that I saw, but don't know how much I was like actually paying attention to it. I only remembered the cannibalism at the end.
Yes.
Yes. I suffered the same only remembering that this movie. Yes.
I remember enjoying it. A lot of times I will remember my emotional response to a movie more than I remember the movie itself or the story or anything like that. I remember enjoying it, but I had no recollection of what the story was about, and I had only seen it that once.
All you had for years was just secrets in the south.
Yeah, right?
Just in your head.
I feel like, and I'm curious to hear back from our listeners, I feel like this is actually something that is pretty common in terms of just how, I don't know, sometimes with movies, no matter how well done they are, and this movie does a lot of things very well, that there is just one completely unrelated thing taken away from the movie that people are like, yeah, that's what I remember. And I also only remembered the cannibalism. I saw this movie. I have like a very lovely memory associated with this movie, in spite of the fact that I don't really remember what happened, obviously. But my grandma showed me this movie. She was the best. She loved showing us movies that she liked and talking loudly throughout them, which is probably why I don't know anything that happened in the movie. But this was like a movie that I watched at her house in Maine when I was like maybe, I don't know, like maybe around the same age, like 10-ish, when you're like allowed to start watching these movies, but like with your relatives. So I watched it with my mom and my grandma, and they didn't get along, but they got along for the duration of this movie. And it was a really nice memory. And I miss my grandma, and I didn't remember anything that happened in the movie except for the cannibalism. Maybe that just has to do with being very young when you see this movie. We're so, I mean, for sure, a great deal of it was over my head. Mm-hmm. And also my grandma was most likely just talking at volume screaming.
Yeah.
About how cannibalism was going to happen. That's my
guess. I love how you're like, these movies, when you are allowed to watch them, and by these, I mean movies about cannibals.
Right.
You remember that time when your grandma and grandfather just sat you down and like, you're like, okay, honey, it's time.
There is like, there was like a time, I think it was around the time I was like between 9 and 11, where like my mom, because my mom was very in control of like my media diet, and she would be like, okay, we're going to start introducing mature themes. You know, like this was like one of those movies.
Light petting.
Light petting.
Cannibalism.
Maybe just the idea of cannibal, kind of a lighthearted cannibalism by a very villainous character. So you're like, oh, who cares?
Right.
Which is a feeling I uphold to this day about the cannibalism. but in any case, let's talk about what happens in the movie.
Yeah, let's do it. So we start in rural Alabama in the, I believe it's set in the 80s.
Yeah, I think it's set and when the book was written, so like 87-ish.
87, yeah. Movie comes out in 91, but yeah, I think it's sort of a period piece by like 4 years.
Weird.
And we meet Evelyn Couch, a.k.a. Kathy Bates, queen.
Woohoo!
And her husband, Ed. They go to a nursing home to visit his aunt, who hates Evelyn, so she starts to wander around the nursing home and runs into a woman named Mrs. Threadgood, but she goes by Ninny.
Yes.
And Ninny starts to tell a story about a murder that took place many years ago.
Yeah. Moida.
And you're like, oh, it's a little Julie and Julia. It's a bit of a story within a story, which I also fully did not remember.
Me either. I did not remember that, but
I thought Kathy Bates was right there with everyone else. I was wrong.
I feel like the parallels between Fried Green Tomatoes and Titanic are
many
there.
And you also mentioned The Notebook as a movie with parallels. I saw some parallels with Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Also, the poster for this movie kind of leads you to believe that all four of the female leads are together in the movie because they're all on the poster and it's kind of photoshopped to make it seem like they're together. Looking at the poster, you would believe that it is four women and a freight train that star in the movie.
I just see a green tomato in this poster, but it does make me think that a tomato is a main character. So I get the confusion.
I will send it to the chat. One of the main posters for this movie is four women and a freight train, and you do have to hand it to them for not putting a single man on the poster, but also being like, we have to include the train. The murderous train. Perhaps
that train keeps killing teenagers. It's ripping limbs off of kids.
This train hates men.
Feminist icon, this train.
Yeah.
This train listens to the Bechdel cast.
We don't endorse killing beloved brothers and sons. I think that the actions of the train were rather ruthless. And
especially because the men and boys who get killed or injured in the story seem to be perfectly nice and respectful.
She doesn't choose her targets very well. That I'll say about this train. She needs to, like, there are men in this community who deserve to be hit by a train.
There are many members of the KKK who should have been.
There's the Klan and there's cops and there's racists.
Yeah.
But they're just hitting people. In fact, this train seems to have a very specific vendetta against people named Buddy.
True.
That's true.
I'm quickly not on board with the train anymore. What was she thinking?
Bad train.
Bad train.
Bad. Okay.
Also, I was like, is it progressive for the sudden death of a teenage boy to change everyone's life? Because in every movie, it's we have to kill Shailene Woodley, or how is this guy going to learn a lesson? And we have to kill Mandy Moore in A Walk to Remember, or how is this guy going to learn a lesson? In this one, we kill Chris O'Donnell with a train right away. And then...
And she learns the lesson of, I'm a lesbian.
I don't know if Chris O'Donnell getting hit by the train teaches her that, but it does move things in that, you know, it keeps these characters together.
Okay, so what's happening in the story? Ninny starts to tell a story from her past to Evelyn, aka Kathy Bates. And we cut to a flashback as she's beginning to tell the story. We are now in post-World War I era. We meet Iggy Threadgood. She's a little girl. She's a tomboy. And then we also meet her beloved older brother, Buddy. Buddy is in love with Ruth Jameson, who is played
Change
by...
Change from the book.
What?
Change from the book.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That is not the case in the book. But in the movie, they are little lovebirds. Mm-hmm. Ruth is played by Mary Louise Parker. And one day they're all out for a stroll and Buddy gets his foot caught on the railroad track and he is struck and killed by this bad train.
It's extremely old timey and sad.
Especially because you see a very quick shot of him finally pulling his foot out of his boot and
yes.
You think he's gonna survive, but then he's still killed, and I was very confused on the physics of that.
It was a strange editing choice to include
sure.
him getting out of the boot. I don't know if that was a part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was edited, I thought that he had survived and maybe would be like injured but okay, but they were like mm-hmm. nope, he didn't.
He's dead.
Rip.
Yes.
And he's on the train tracks because he's trying to get Ruth's hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's starting to blow away and you're like immediately you're like, this is bad. This is bad.
What if the train and the hat are working together and it's like collusion
okay.
and they're trying to kill okay. all the buddies of the world?
Yeah. Crime, green tomatoes. This is
most
really
things named Buddy, I feel like, are dogs. Let's just be like...
Yeah, Air Bud.
Yeah, exactly. Air Bud.
Because we just roasted the editing on this movie, I just did the quickest Google of my life brag. And so there is a female editor on this movie, Deborah Neal Fisher. Her resume is so extensive. She edited Sonic the Hedgehog this year.
Whoa.
She edited 2/3 of the 50 Shades of Grey franchise. She edited every Hangover movie. She edited Baby Mama.
That's
she
curveball.
Edited all of the Austin Powers. She's
Whoa.
Just, she's edited Yumi and Dupree. She's edited all sorts of movies. So just if you were worried that she lost work because she showed Buddy getting out of his boot and confusing us.
She did not.
She's fine. She's fine.
In every single one of those films, someone is hit by a train. I think if the common thread.
That's her signature thing. Even if it has nothing to do with the movie, she edits it into the movie.
She writes. Yeah, well, editors are often, you know, the real authors. It's weird. I don't remember Sonic the Hedgehog ever getting hit by a train, but in this movie, he does.
I think of all the movies, that's the one I would definitely assume it happened in.
Dupree for sure gets hit by a train.
Oh, yeah. You, me, and what?
Name like, a 50 Shades movie where Dakota Johnson doesn't get hit by a train. It's her trademark.
So, okay. So back to the movie. He's killed by the train and Iggy is heartbroken over this. Mm-hmm. It's also around this point in the story where we formally meet Big George.
Yes.
As well as less formally meet his mother, Sipsy.
Cicely Tyson.
Yep. They are two black people who work for the Threadgood family because they're like a rich, wealthy white family who has help.
Mm-hmm.
And Big George does a lot to look after Iggy specifically. Okay, so the story is unfolding, but just then Kathy Bates' husband comes in and interrupts a typical man. And we see them go back home a little bit. Evelyn Couch has been going to these marriage counseling classes, I think. Mm-hmm. She's kind of trying to connect with Ed better, but he's not into it. He does not appreciate her.
This whole plot point, we'll come back to it.
And only counseling women. all together, not couples.
Yes, the husbands are not present. Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, Ed is asked nothing, which I appreciate that commentary, but I feel like the movie kind of goes out of its way to make women trying to get in touch with their sexuality better to seem ridiculous and perhaps hysterical. I didn't like how those were framed.
Oh, sure.
Anyways.
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
So then sometime later, Evelyn goes back to the nursing home and hears more of the story from Ninny. So we flash back to Iggy, who is all grown up now, and she is Mary Stuart Masterson. And she has not really recovered from the loss of her brother Buddy. And Ruth, who again was Buddy's young love, comes around and befriends her. We see them getting into all kinds of hijinks. They're giving out food to poor people. There's a scene with honey and bees. They play poker. They get drunk together, things like that.
I love the bee scene so much.
It truly, I was brimming with anxiety.
Oh, I loved it.
And though the movie never makes this explicit, it's pretty clear that Iggy is a lesbian who is falling in love with Ruth, and Ruth also loves her.
Yes.
And we'll talk about all of this later. But Ruth gets married to a man named Frank Bennett. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we already know from the beginning of the story, based on what Ninny said, this is a kind of murder mystery about Iggy being accused of murdering Frank Bennett. But we don't yet know how or why or when or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And then we meet Frank Bennett and we're like, thank God he got murdered.
Yeah.
He's terrible.
He is a truly a piece of shit.
Yes.
So she goes off newly married. They move to Georgia. And after a few years, Iggy drives to Georgia to pay Ruth a visit and discovers that Ruth's husband is physically abusive. Mm. So Iggy gets Ruth out of there with the help of Big George and says to Frank, if you ever touch her again, I'll kill you. Mm-hmm. Ruth, who was pregnant when she left her husband.
I'm sorry, Caitlin.
Has the baby.
Say?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Ruth, sad. Who was pregnant.
That's right. Sorry. I don't mean to like tone police, but you did say that word wrong.
I said the word incorrectly. She was pregnant with a Greg named Buddy.
Right. That's just his nickname though. His name is Greg.
And then Iggy and Ruth open a restaurant, the Whistle Stop Cafe, where they served fried green tomatoes.
That's the name
of the movie. Mm-hmm.
Yay.
And barbecue that Big George makes. This becomes important. Frank shows up a couple of times trying to get his baby. And
he's
one
Greg.
Night we see him. One night we see him being knocked out by a shovel, I think, which he then presumably dies from.
Well, because he's trying to kidnap a baby.
Yeah, he's got baby basket in the hand. He's about to make away with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's also a member of the KKK, we find out. So we are not sad that he dies.
Oh, yeah.
Later, some police from Georgia show up to the cafe to see if Iggy or Ruth know anything about Frank's disappearance. And they're like, no. And he's like, well, I don't trust you, but I do love your barbecue. Nom, 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 nom. And then Iggy tells Ruth, like, you don't have to worry about Frank coming around anymore. And Ruth is like, well, did you kill him? And she's like, no, I didn't.
No, but I know he's for sure dead. And
yeah, but I definitely know he's dead, but I won't tell you why.
I felt for Ruth in that moment because she's just like, okay, I don't think you're a murderer, but you're sounding awful like a murderer. And Mary Stuart Masterson is like, just be cool.
Yeah. Please stop asking.
Yep. Then several years pass, and one day Frank's pickup truck is found in a river. So Iggy and Big George are arrested for his murder. And she is tried, but the judge throws out the case because he's like, well, you know, Frank just probably got drunk and drove into the river by accident and got eaten by river creatures, which...
It seems like Iggy is such a beloved person in this community that the judge kind of just didn't want anything bad to happen.
Yeah.
Like, that was my read on
it. It was the role of the priest, remember?
Yeah.
Right, because the priest kind of lied, and then the judge kind of did a bad job, but it, like, worked out the way it should have.
Right. It works out well for the characters who we are rooting for. But I'm also just like, is this how the justice system worked in 1933?
No, not at all. Definitely, if there was a black man accused of killing a white man, he probably wouldn't have gotten off. And especially if there was a white woman who everyone knew was gay, that's not what would have happened. But look, this is Hollywood, all right?
This is fantasy, yes.
This is amazing. That's why this movie rules.
Mm-hmm. Things turn out the way they should, except Ruth dies.
Yeah, and like human flesh breaks down into a great sauce somehow that no one can taste.
Well, we don't know. Weird. We don't know. We, you know?
We don't know.
We,
we
don't know. We, have we ever tried it?
Ask the train.
We don't. It might.
But yes, justice was served to the characters who we like.
Yes.
Meanwhile, back in the present, Evelyn has begun this journey of kind of self-liberation. She's knocking down walls in her house. She's crashing her car into other people's cars. She goes back to see Ninny, who continues the story about Iggy and Ruth. Ruth has gotten sick and dies of cancer.
Which is so sad.
So sad. Heartbreaking.
I was bawling. It was, whew.
Yeah.
Rough.
Story of the ducks.
Yeah, the duck story. Oh. I'm like, this story is so boring and I don't get it, but I'm crying.
And then back in the present, Evelyn thinks that Ninny has died, but it turns out that it was just Ninny's roommate at the nursing home who died. So Evelyn goes to find Ninny, who tells Evelyn the final bit of the story, which is that it turns out it was Sipsy who killed Frank Bennett. And Iggy and Big George, do they barbecue his body or do they turn his body into the sauce? I was not super clear about that.
There is a long night of like Robert Durst style dismemberment that takes place that we don't see.
Yeah.
But they go full Durst that night and we just don't have to watch it. And I'm fine with that.
Sure.
Totally. In any case, they feed his remains to the cop who had been investigating his disappearance. So that's like the big
poetic
reveal
justice
at the end of the movie.
Great.
Hence the cannibalism that Jamie and I remembered. Yeah, that's the story. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come right back.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
And we're back. That sounded like, hey, what's that movie? They're back.
We're back. A Dinosaur Story. Oh, that's Poltergeist? We're here? No.
I don't know. We're so young, so we just don't know.
We forget. Yeah, I think it's Poltergeist sounds right.
But she says something like, they're here.
Yes. I think a good place to start talking about this movie is the way it was adapted, because I feel like that leads into a lot of the discussion that kind of needs to be had about this movie. So there's mm-hmm. so much context for this movie, and a lot of it is very interesting and some of it is kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. So we have the very rare example here of the author of an original work co-authoring a screenplay. That is amazing. Fanny Flagg, mm-hmm. who I wasn't familiar with her, but now that I learned more about her, she's awesome. She is a queer writer and comedian who got started in the 60s, went on to become a really popular game show personality on Match Game. If you grew mm-hmm. up watching Game Show Network with your grandparents, that was a thrill. And later in her career was openly an out lesbian who had just a murderer's row of girlfriends. She dated Rita Mae Brown, another really famous queer writer, and a really famous soap opera star named Susan Flannery. If you want to look up the relationship between the three of them, it's very interesting. Not necessarily mm-hmm. not relevant to the podcast, but I was hooked. Mm-hmm. In any case, she wrote this novel in 1987 and then was approached by the director of this movie, John Avnet, to write the movie herself. She had never written for the screen. I feel like this is very rare for any marginalized writer to get an opportunity to go from zero to writing their own screenplay of their own work. So that's incredible. She enlists her friend Carol Sobieski, who also wrote the script for Annie. They work on it together. Carol unfortunately passes away before the movie comes out, but they are both honored with an Academy Award nomination. So it's a beautiful story in that way. What I do think is interesting is, and again, we haven't read the book, so if you have read the book and you have a more detailed, nuanced take, I'm just going off of the academic pieces I was able to find about the adaptation of this. And although Fanny Flagg is an openly queer writer, there seems to be a lot of debate on, for sure in the movie, it is coding, coding, coding till the end of time coding. In the book, there does seem to be a little bit of debate. It is definitely less coded, but it is also never explicitly stated. There are some fans of this book who say it is not coded, it is very clear, but the wording that Fanny Flagg uses is a little obscure, so there are some people that argue that it's still coded. I don't know. I haven't read the book.
It's my understanding that the word lesbian never appears in the book, but other pretty specific indicators that explicitly say that they are a couple who are in love and romantically involved are very present in the book.
So there's, again, the debate gets kind of really nuanced because people who are fans of this book are like, go super hard. And I was like, in some forums. And yes, so from just what I read, it seems to me like it is not coded in the book, but they also, like, people were like, well, they never, like, kiss. There's not a lot of physical interaction or affection shown in the book. And so some people are like, it's not explicit enough because they are not, like, you know, they're a married couple that aren't kissing. Hello, you know, so there's all that. But there are these very, like, to me, like, very romantic passages that I was like, oh, I should read this book. Here's a quote from the book. Oh, and also the word, like, wife, girlfriend, partner, that never comes up. They are pretty exclusively called friends and business partners in the book. So, you know, if you're a fan of the book, let us know. So, okay. When Iggy, this is from a scene when Iggy is upset that Ruth is leaving to go marry Frank Bennett. Towards the beginning of the book, and she says, oh no, you don't love him, you love me, you know you do. So it is way more explicit of like, don't marry him, stay here, be my girlfriend. But so
yeah,
wow, that's very different than the movie.
Yes So I think it's really interesting, like an interesting case study that Fanny Flagg wrote both that passage and this movie where the relationship is presented very differently.
1991.
Very 1991. That said, this movie did win a GLAAD award,
yes,
for portraying a lesbian relationship. So it was, mm-hmm, I think, clear to queer audiences what this movie was, but it isn't explicitly stated, even less so in the movie than in the book. But it also, it's, I don't know, it's kind of, it's, it was an interesting watch because, like, watching it, you're just like, oh yeah, they're obviously in love, and they're like, mm-hmm, you know, this is like this long-standing, you know, marriage. They have a child together. Like, it's,
they, mm-hmm, raise a child together, they run a business together.
Yeah, it's very,
they, yeah,
but it, I mean, it's coded.
I couldn't remember, looking back, and when I rewatched it, I couldn't remember whether they ever kissed, and the time when they would have kissed, I think, is when they were like drunk and lying by the riverbank and talking about how she's gonna probably have to get married soon, and they, you know, she was, it's her birthday,
that
she's like,
scene.
Yeah, I mean she kisses her on the cheek, and then Ruth does, yeah, and then jumps into the water, and it's all very, oh my god, it's lovely, but the relationship
it.
Is so deep, even though there is, I mean, it's physical, they're like, they have a food fight.
And that food fight was...
The director makes...
Director John, yeah, Avnet saying, I think on the DVD commentary, that he intended for that food fight to be seen as symbolic of lovemaking.
Yeah, which I do think is, first of all, it's like, sir, how are we supposed to know that? It is like a really sweet scene, and I love Mary Stuart Masterson and Mary Louise Parker play so well off of each other. I like fully, mm-hmm, buy that they are in love, and they're like, it's so sweet. But it's like, if you're a viewer in 1991, you're like, they were in a food fight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was not, it wasn't, they weren't like, you know, like, it wasn't, that was him being like, that's sex. You're like, sir, have you heard of sex before? In any case, if you know that that is how he was thinking of that scene, it is kind of interesting to watch, because right after they are like caught having a food fight,
yeah,
the cop friend comes, mm-hmm, over, who is pursuing Iggy, and says like, this isn't right. Women shouldn't be doing stuff like this. And if you're reading the scene as a food fight, it's a very strange comment to make. But
right.
But if you're reading it as they have a relationship with each other, I do believe that that's how he viewed that scene. I just think that it's weird that he thinks that that is an extremely clear read for a viewer, because I don't think it, mm-hmm, was. But I love that scene. It's very sweet. I love them.
Yeah.
I just think all the language in the film that refers to Iggy is both, it's like 1991 and then very Jim Crow South, like 40s, 50s language around, like, she's different, she's a little weird, she's not like, sure, other girls, you know, she wears pants, like, there's just a lot of like hilariously you know, skirting around the fact that she's gay, and pretty, yeah, much everyone knows it.
It is funny, there was a lot of elements of Iggy's character that reminded me of Katharine Hepburn characters, where, mm, like, so many Katharine Hepburn characters were just thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly queer coded, and it was through, mm-hmm, like the tomboy aesthetic. It was through like all these coded phrases that, yeah, that are just frequently used to just avoid letting a queer character be a queer character. I also found, right, an interesting, Mary Stuart Masterson apparently is the realest one of all time, because I was able to find an interview that she did in 2017 with queer writer Kate Arthur, who also, mm-hmm, wrote a really great piece about this movie and just breaking down,
yes,
what it meant for its time. But she does a great interview with Mary Stuart Masterson, and it straight up asks, like, you know, she says, because she loves this movie, Kate Arthur is like, this is a movie for lesbians. Like, don't you agree? Essentially. And Mary Stuart Masterson responds with like some kind of like righteous frustration and says that, okay, so I'm just reading from Kate Arthur's piece here. Mm-hmm. The movie is, as Masterson once told me, quote unquote, redacted. So Mary Stuart Masterson says, quote, it wasn't a love scene, but they were like clearly a love relationship type of fight or jealousy. There was some more sensual kind of stuff in there. We were clearly playing that. So there are deleted scenes from this movie that make the relationship mm-hmm. more explicitly clear, even though it seems like, much like in the book, the language of you are my wife, this is our marriage, that was mm-hmm. certainly not going to be in the movie. But like relationship scenes were in this movie and then later cut. She goes on to say, at that time, it was just about friendship. I think at the time when it was released, if it had been labeled frankly that way, I think the fear was maybe that it would have alienated all the people, older Southern women, who had those kinds of permanent lifelong friendships. The aunts who lived together but never married would have been alienated from watching it and allowing themselves to love the characters. I think that they might have been afraid. So that was Mary Stuart Masterson's take, and she is just generally frustrated that they weren't allowed to be in a relationship because she says Mary Stuart Masterson and Mary Louise Parker were like, yeah, we were, the characters were in a relationship and we played it that way.
Right.
So
I don't know, though, that response from Mary Stuart Masterson, like, I appreciate her frustration, but her thinking it's going to alienate like old Southern aunts who live together romantically, that threw me a little bit. Like, I don't think that's who it's going to alienate. Like, if anything, they would be the people who would potentially connect most to this movie. Like, if it's going to alienate anyone, it would be homophobes, which in 91 was a large portion of the population. So, like, to me, it's clear that the movie was trying to play it safe and appeal to a larger audience by making the relationship between Iggy and Ruth way more like subtextual and implicit.
The movie is very feathered edges. I mean, the story is cool. I bet the book is way better because the movie version is super Hollywoodified, like, you know, cue music and yay, we're not going to get too deep. We don't know the relationship. Like, it's just, it's not edgy. It's probably not what would have, even though it's edgy, but not edgy.
good one.
Not what 2020 might have done to the story.
Exactly.
So going even deeper on what, so I was like, okay, well, how does Fanny Flagg feel about this? Because she wrote a queer novel that does, you know, goes all the way up to the line of saying this is the relationship, this is a marriage that takes place. How does she feel about the changes that were made to the movie? We know movies get written all the time and shit gets cut out. And so it's not like this is, you know, her complete script that was shot, right? Mm-hmm. But she, again, kind of surprises you with what her answer is. She has said kind of throughout that she was basing Ruth and Iggy partially on relatives in her own life. She's from the South. She said it was based, at least the idea for them having a business and running a business came from her family and not a queer relationship. But she's a queer writer writing about a queer relationship. So in any case, someone asked her this question in 1992 of like, how do you feel about the relationship being far less explicit? And she says to Entertainment Weekly, quote, it's a mainstream movie. People are taking children. They're taking old people. It speaks to everybody. That's why it's wonderful. They can make up their own minds, which is very much the vibe of the reviews of this movie. Because I was curious about like, well, how did an audience receive it? Was your average, you know, film bro journalist just kind of like not picking up on it? Like, what was the vibe? Mm-hmm. Almost every review I read were well aware. They're like, oh, this is a queer relationship. But they kind of toe the line in the same way that Fanny Flagg does and says, well, you can see this as a relationship or not. Either way, I liked the movie, but it's very like wishy-washy in the way that it's approached.
You would think that would have just dropped after they didn't win an Oscar and just be like, you know what? Fuck you.
It was gay the whole time.
Yeah.
There's like this review from Ty Burr that says, it's also in Entertainment Weekly. He says, like in the novel, Tomatoes uses female friendship as a metaphor for something taboo, but the story is in no way diminished if you choose not to buy into it. there are hints of earthly desires nevertheless. I'm like, okay, the most virginal thing I've ever read in my whole life. But but like that is kind of the tone of how this movie was received by critics of like, I really liked it. Seems like there's a queer relationship. I didn't think about it too hard. Night, like that was just the vibe.
I have a couple additional quotes from Fanny Flagg about the movie saying that, quote, it's not a political film at all. It's about the possibilities of people being sweet and loving each other. Another quote, it's a story about love and friendship. The sexuality is unimportant. So,
but even outside of the queer relationship, it's very explicitly a political film, like, and a book.
Right.
So,
yes.
Fanny. On a number of levels.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm the most interested in what this queer relationship meant and means for Evelyn in the 80s. Like, would Evelyn, if Ninny told her, like, yeah, so then we slept together, you know, would she be like, ew, you know, would she freak out? Like, I'm curious in the book how they play it for Evelyn. You know, is Ninny sort of dampening down that part for Evelyn? Does it say anything about Evelyn's sexuality and her relationship with Ed?
I have to be honest, I kind of like don't care that much about Evelyn or her life.
I do. I'm like a fan of that character, and we can talk about her in a bit, but like, yeah, that is something I hadn't fully considered, because like Evelyn does go through this sort of like liberation, and like, is that due in part to kind of learning about this queer relationship? And because a lot of what Iggy does, in addition to having a woman as her lover, she's challenging the status quo in many other ways as well. Like, you know, how she presents herself, how she dresses. She doesn't go to church.
Right.
She drinks. She gambles. She plays baseball. She fishes. She does a lot of things that would have been considered unladylike.
She's cool.
By like polite she's society, and especially in this era and especially in this region. But yeah, she's like fuck all that, I'm gonna do whatever the hell I want. I'm cool. That is an aspect of her character that I really appreciated.
Oh, I love her. She reminds me of a Katharine Hepburn character, but the twist is she doesn't have to marry any old guy at the end. Like, it's cool.
She doesn't have to marry Cary Grant.
Yeah, I mean, even down to the, and this is like a trope that I'm kind of less fond of, but it does kind of line up with that Katharine Hepburn parallel I'm trying to draw here of like, she is like the wealthy daughter of a white family that understands like the working man. And that is like another hallmark of that kind of character archetype that Iggy kind of plays to a T here, where she does come from a lot of privilege. She's not like the other girls. It's very,
Well, what I think is particularly interesting about this whole situation and adaptation and what gets omitted and not is that, like, if this movie was like almost made like 20 years from now and it was the exact same thing, we would almost, I think we could like look at it like, wow, look how normalized their lesbian relationship is. Like, look, they're just,
they're beloved members of the community. Everyone loves them.
Right. Like, and like, by not identifying, like not being like, and they're definitely lesbians together, kind of normalizes it.
Yeah.
But it's not what's happening in the movie, because in the context of when this came out in 91, audiences were so conditioned to expect hetero relationships between a cishet man and cishet woman in mainstream Hollywood movies. Like, audiences were not at all conditioned to expect queer relationships. We were so starved for queer visibility on screen that, like, media needed to then and still needs to actually identify characters as queer so that we have that clear visibility and we as audience members know that about those characters.
Yeah.
Again, we will move to a place at some point down the road where there is more normalization, but
that's a really interesting thing that's a really interesting point. Right there, because here you have this queer woman writing this story that she's like, I want this to be universal. And we're talking about it on a podcast about the Bechdel test, which never gets passed in movies. And now it's like, well, can it only be passed if two women are in a romantic relationship with one another? Like, is that the minus, you know, in the mathematic equation? It's like, unless they're fucking, it doesn't count. You know what I mean? Like,
well, the context of the Bechdel test, which first appeared in Alison Bechdel's comic Dykes to Watch Out For, 1985, her characters were talking about how they saw so little visibility of lesbians on screen in movies that they had to imagine that two women talking to each other about something other than a man, if that happened in the movie, they'd be like, well, now we can ship them together as lovers.
Yeah.
And that's what spawned the Bechdel test.
Which is so... Well, yeah, it like is maybe one of our only movies we've ever covered that connects it pretty exactly of like, this is what the Bechdel test was actually supposed to be about. This is also like a kind of a big cultural moment for movies of this nature and this exact framing of like friendship, friendship, friendship. It's just friends, because Thelma and Louise comes out just, I think, a few months before Fried Green Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So 91 is huge for movies that have a huge cult following today and a pretty significant queer following that at the time were very framed of like, friends, which, well, it is interesting because I think that the framing device is truly just two women becoming friends in a way that I found to be like really effective and like, lovely and sweet of like, oh, these are, it's an intergenerational friendship. They're able to help each other through different phases of life and struggling with aging and all this stuff. And like, that was so beautiful. But it is like frustrating to see what is pretty clearly a queer relationship kind of not that like friendship is a reduct, but like when you're in a relationship with someone, you don't want someone to be like, that's your friend. That's your business partner. Like, right. No, this is I'm raising a child.
All you do is fry tomatoes together.
we're rearing a child. We're not just frying tomatoes here. Like, yeah.
Well, I kind of wanted to bring up the Hays production code.
Ooh.
It's not the most applicable thing to this movie, but I think we see remnants of it in movies long after the code was lifted. Mm-hmm. So just a little background from someone who has not one but two degrees in film. Thank you very much. I hate to bring it up.
I feel 18 again. I was like, oh, the Hays Code.
Wow. So the production code was a set of censorship rules, more or less, that films had to abide by in order to get any kind of wide theatrical release. This was enforced from 1934 to, I believe, 1968. And the rules were such things as, like, there could be no graphic violence, there could be no swearing, there could be no overt sexuality. Mm-hmm. When it was lifted in 1968, it was replaced by the MPAA rating system, which is like the rated G, rated PG, rated R, PG-13 came later, etc. This is according to, again, our favorite scholarly website, Wikipedia. It says, in terms of homosexuality, while the code did not explicitly state that depictions of homosexuality were against the code barred the depiction of any kind of sexual perversion or deviance which homosexuality fell under at the time. Mm. Gay characters on screen also came to be represented as villains or victims who commit crimes due to their homosexuality. So I feel like part of it is just kind of the cultural climate around queerness. I mean, during this era, as well as many years before and after this, most filmmakers who have historically been cishet white men either had no interest in including queer characters or felt like it was too big of a risk to include queer characters because of the rampant queer phobia in our society.
Even Fanny Flagg is referencing, like, this movie is for everyone, and the subtext being, well, like, a queer relationship can't be in a movie for everyone because it is something that is othered.
Right.
I don't want to dig into her personal life. It does seem, because she dated another really famous lesbian writer who did not code anything, it seemed like this was kind of a tendency in her work of wanting to write in a universal way, but the definition of universal kind of ended up othering her own experiences, which isn't fair. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I mean, like, could have been her also caving to societal pressures to conform to heteronormative standards. Or maybe she did try to push back more and just wasn't able to get results.
Yeah, I mean, and in that same really good BuzzFeed essay that I'll refer you to again, it's called Why Fried Green Tomatoes is a Lesbian Classic. Yes, lesbian. That's the title. It's really
fun. I read that too.
But Kate Arthur is also putting this in, and Francesca, you also kind of reference this because it applies in a number of ways in this movie, but like, this was a movie that came out like at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And when, you know, the first Bush administration was completely ignoring an epidemic that was ravaging queer communities. And this was a queer story, however coded, that essentially, outside of the whole cancer death, ended well and ended beautifully, and they were accepted by their community. And on, I mean, and we haven't even started to talk about the race plotline of this movie, but you know, a black man is brought to court and he is successful and in beloved by the community, and like, just, it's societally speaking kind of like a fairy tale, especially for when this
total fairy tale,
like where and when this takes place. You have to imagine none of this would go the way it goes.
Yeah.
But but I wasn't framing it in like, oh yeah, 1991 is, especially for like in a movie market where there are not certainly no like lesbian relationships being released in on a massive scale, and to like, this movie was so successful. It like made its budget back 13 times or something like that. And it kind of like frames everything in this like, and it all basically ended well and everyone had a beautiful relationship, and except for Ruth, went on to live lovely lives, and they met Kathy Bates maybe because Jessica Tandy is Mary Stuart Masterson. That is definitely not in the book. And maybe that is confusing.
Yeah.
That twist ending I thought was excellent. I mean, there's just like that layer of the plot of Ninny being Iggy, Iggy being Ninny is so good. And I just want a sequel where we find out what happened to Iggy in between all that time after Ruth dies, but before we meet her in the retirement home.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's definitely, it's made, it's, there's a clear distinction in the book that Iggy is not Ninny. The fact that it's suggested at in the movie is something that I think a lot of the fans of the book absolutely hate.
Yes.
But not all, but
readers aren't better than watchers, everybody. I just want
the Titanic reference. I thought the second I saw that like reveal of like, it was like, the woman in the picture is me. You're just like, that is so what happens. It's the woman in the picture was her. Okay, fine. She has a picture of Mary Louise Parker on her desk. Whatever. Like, it didn't bother me, but I also, if I had read that book and was a big fan of that book, I would have been really bothered by that change for sure. I don't know. My main take, like, there's, my takeaway from this movie is I still have a crush on Mary Louise Parker after all these years. She is so beautiful and so
solid takeaway,
funny, and I am in love with her.
We got to take a quick break and then we'll come right back.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
And we're back. One quick thing, and then we'll move on. The one other movie change that they very explicitly made for the adaptation that I'm like, are you serious? Was that they changed the introduction of Ruth. Is she's introduced as a love interest of doomed brother Buddy who gets hit by the train. Mm-hmm. In the book, I think in a way that takes a layer of coding away, she is not introduced as like, you know, a girl who's interested in a guy. She's introduced as like, here's a girl who's staying with us for the summer, and that's just it. But the movie kind of goes out of its way to say that she is interested in men the first time we see her. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess according to the movie she is bisexual but also straight but also question mark, because it's for everyone. It's annoying.
I read too that in the book we have a clearer understanding of why she marries Frank Bennett, which is that she and her mother needed his financial support, or else they would have probably had to experience homelessness. Because this part of the story takes place during the Depression. So a lot of people had fallen on very hard financial times. So Ruth in the book marries Frank because she needed a financial support system.
Yeah.
Another Titanic parallel? Yes.
Yeah, they could have given, I think, Ruth a little bit more backstory. Iggy had so much backstory, and Ruth was just kind of appeared in the movie.
But then she's
and that would have been a nice
detail. When Iggy is fishing and Ruth is like, come on, spend time with me. It'll be fun. And Iggy's like, fine. And then they fall in love.
And she's like, fine, get on a train with me. We're going to be socialists, redistributing the wealth.
And then Mary Louise Parker gets all wet, and it's just a good movie. yeah. Okay. So this will sort of bring us into the next area of discussion, is another thing that is done in the book that is very Hollywood whitewashed in the movie is in the book. And again, I was not able to find a ton of hyper specific details. Caitlin, let me know if you have more than I do. But in the book, the black characters in this community and in the lives of Ruth and Iggy have actual stories, and they just are more characters than they are in this movie, because there are so many scenes in this movie where black characters are actively involved and present, where they do not have dialogue, where you are not really given a look into what they're thinking, how they're thinking. There is at least one character from the book that doesn't even end up in the movie at all. And yeah, especially when it's like you cast Cicely Tyson and you're not gonna give her anything to do when she can do anything. It was so this movie is like heavily whitewashed.
Yeah, the one thing she does ends up happening off screen for the most part.
I know, and it's the best.
This is kind of a classic case of a story that is about white people, in which there are a few black characters who are kind of there to serve as scenery or to help and serve the white characters. We never learn anything about their lives in the movie. I don't think we even learn Sipsy's name until like an hour into the movie.
Way late, yeah.
I don't think it's established that Sipsy is Big George's mother until the very end. So we don't even know what their relationship is exactly.
In the book, she's his adopted mother. And then there's also a sister-in-law who doesn't appear in the movie. There's like a whole family. They have a whole family dynamic in the movie. In the book that is just kind of done away with in the movie entirely.
Yes, it is annoying that it's not actually more present, but like they are pivotal in the actual like what happens, the killing, the sauce eating, the cannibalism.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Which makes it like even more frustrating to me that they are, in spite of the fact that like it's clear that the material being adapted, Big George and Sipsy are really active characters, but in the movie you don't actually get to see them doing much. It's a plot point that you don't see what Sipsy does.
Right. Right. It's a really weird storytelling choice to make an extremely pivotal moment in the story of like Sipsy killing Frank Bennett. So have her character be very important in that regard. But prior to that, barely. I mean, she will be in the background. She's present, but she's not ever given the focus.
They're putting Cicely Tyson in the background. So much. There is one scene in particular where I feel like these problems are especially on display. And again, we want to hear from our Black listeners of what you made of every choice this movie made as well. But there is the sequence where basically we find out that Frank, Ruth's ex-husband, is in the KKK, mm-hmm. and that the KKK is inciting violence against Big George. Mm-hmm. Also right outside the store, but it takes Mary Stuart Masterson a very long time to hear it for some reason. It is happening literally right outside the window, but whatever. It's just this whole scene that is pivoting around KKK violence that somehow ends up becoming about the relationship of the white women in the story. Our takeaway from a KKK violence scene is that we are very concerned with the personal lives of these white women. I love those characters, but that just felt so...
It's the Hollywoodization erasure also. I mean, I just think in the same ways that this film sort of appeals to people's homophobia and like sort of dances around it and coddles it, it sort of coddles people's racism too. Like, we're not going to have these characters say or do much more. In fact, all they're doing really is being like super ride or die for Iggy and Ruth for no reason other than they're employed by them. I mean, it seems, right? But it's like, but we still will put our lives on the line. You know, Big George is beaten and whipped by the KKK. And you kind of assume it's like, yes, he loves Iggy and Ruth.
We are told constantly this great relationship that Iggy has with Big George, but we are not shown it. No real estate was dedicated in the story, in the movie version.
We never see them have a conversation that's just the two of
them. Barely. Yeah. Or if it is, it's just like a very in passing, like, you know, how's the barbecue today? You know, it's very inconsequential.
I thought Big George got her out of trouble once. Like, he goes to meet with her. Am I misremembering? There's some moment.
Well, here's a troubling scene to me where after Iggy has discovered that Ruth's husband is abusive and she basically goes to rescue her, she brings Big George and her brother, Julian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they show up and, you know, Frank is being an abusive asshole. And Julian, the brother, says, you know, I wouldn't do that if I were you. You might upset Big George and he's crazy. And then it cuts to Big George pulling out a knife. And that, to me, was like, because there's been so much propaganda perpetuated by white people throughout the centuries, painting black men as brutes and as violent, like perpetrators of violence.
Yeah.
And for him to like use that and be like, he's gonna kill you. Look how, you know, big and scary he is basically what's being implied in this scene. I was like, oh no. Yeah.
Right. Again, this book and movie take place in this kind of willful fantasy version of the Depression era South, but this is the Jim Crow era. Like, there are so many, and it's lightly referenced by characters we're supposed to like. Who is that guy? Grady?
Are we supposed to like him?
I'd love to talk about Grady.
I think we are supposed to like him, which is wild because he is homophobic and racist.
And a cop.
He's a cop, and there's also a reference to like, and you and your boys, when you put on your sheets and you walk around.
Like, she's like, you're in the KKK, and he's like, shrug. Yeah.
Grady's also in the KKK.
He's 100% in the KKK.
Yes. But it's like, Iggy hangs out with them a lot. They do a talent show together. So I don't think that we're supposed to hate him.
No, we're supposed to like him.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to like him. And so that is a thing. So, I mean, I guess maybe that is one of the more realistic characters. But it's frustrating. I mean, and again, the author of this book and both of the writers of this movie, everyone, I mean, there are not many black people behind the camera for a movie that is trying to make a statement on race. Mm-hmm. Fanny Flagg is a white writer. Carol Sobieski is a white writer. And I was not able to find a ton of writing to how race is handled in this movie, but it is deeply Hollywood. It ignores the historical context in the same way that the queer storyline ignores the historical context, which is kind of seems like it's very intentionally done to mm-hmm. give you a storybookish ending to, I mean, Alabama in the 1930s, mm-hmm. not a place known for its tolerance.
Yeah, if it didn't gloss over those two things, it would be a completely different story.
Yeah.
Right. It would not have... I mean, it doesn't have a happy ending, but it would have even less of one.
And the catharsis of, I mean, it is, movie-wise, the catharsis of an evil KKK abusive husband. Like, name one thing that Frank isn't. He's every bad thing packaged mm-hmm. into one character. It is very satisfying to see him
get turned into sauce,
get
eaten.
Right.
Not see him, but imagine.
Right. So in every way, it's satisfying to see him like really defeated. There's no doubt that this movie wants him dead. But in order to get there, there is so much context that is just ignored, skimmed over, and it happens kind of at the expense of us getting to know the black characters in this movie. I feel like it mm-hmm. is like a problem that starts foundationally with the book, even though the book, you know, we know more about them, we know more about their character journey, but it's, you know, everyone involved in the telling of this story for the most part is a white person, so right.
they do seem, it's very much like a backdrop, hey, backdrop characters, and even mm-hmm. though they're pivotal in what happens in the story, and kind of a comfortable second-class citizenship. You know, not they're not comfortable, but, like, the story is comfortable with the second-class citizenship. Which is, I would say, probably historically accurate for that moment. Like, I'm not... The idea that a white woman like Iggy would be both friends with a cop who also sometimes moonlights in the KKK, but he's not that much of a dipshit like Frank is...
But he has a crush on her, right?
Right, like, and is homies with, like, you know, the help, quote-unquote, right? Like, that feels real for some... Like, I feel like there might have been many, many Iggies who are like, well, I'm not going to treat the person who works in my house as inhuman, but I also have to, like, get along in a small town with this cop who does something I don't agree with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think... I mean, people contain multitudes, and sometimes those multitudes are extremely contradictory.
I'm not interested in the multitudes of a racist cop. Like,
I mean, I wasn't alive in the 1930s, Bragg, but I have to imagine that wouldn't have been uncommon.
Sure.
Where it's weird because, like, among her things that, like, show her kind of challenging the status quo, in addition to, you know, she dresses in, like, kind of masculine clothing and stuff like that, she employs black people in her cafe and has a, like, black section in her restaurant, and, you know, Grady comments on that, yes. and he's like, well, some people around right. here don't like it that you serve black people at your restaurant, and she's like, well, those people can go fuck off.
Yeah.
So, like, she's shown as being an ally, I guess, by 1930s standards, but
right.
I mean, those standards were just, you know, not enough.
Yeah. And I know I keep coming back to this point, but the fact that they, if you haven't had the pleasure of reading about Cicely Tyson's life, first of all, she's alive. She's 95 years old.
Hell yeah. Mm-hmm.
She is but an award away from an EGOT. She's like a true legend. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she is like, she was so well established when this movie came out, and it was a big deal that she did the movie, and then they gave her nothing to do basically for the whole movie is an injustice that I will not recover from.
She's also still working, right? She's on How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she was. Yeah. I don't think that show's on anymore, but it was. She is, she's thriving.
She was also in The Help.
We can't cover that movie ever. But we probably will.
But I mean, it goes to show that, like, prolific Black actors such as her have to take roles such as the one in this movie, such as the one in The Help, because that's right. often all that's afforded to Black actors is these underwritten or tropey Black characters, which is tragic.
Even though she had a really small part as Sipsy, she crushed it. Like,
yeah.
She did a good job. You're right. She needed way more screen time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I feel like in the movie, we just truly don't know enough about her.
Right.
Where Big George, what we do know about him is that he has like worked in a service role for Iggy's family for a really long time. And then he kind of just goes with her through life and is with her because it's like if Iggy is at home, he's working for that family. If Iggy is running a restaurant, he works there. At that restaurant. Like, which is also kind of never explained. It's like he works where Iggy is. And going back to Cicely Tyson, she had been nominated for an Academy Award. And just, I mean, I'm going to reference a video that I need to pull it up and remember the name of the YouTuber. But there's a really good YouTube channel that I like that examines Best Actress Oscar races year to year, mm-hmm. That has done a lot of work in examining, especially when women of color are nominated for Academy Awards, their careers go very differently than a white actress who is nominated and then just gets roles forever.
Nominated, mm-hmm. not necessarily winning, just nominated.
Not even necessarily winning. Yeah. So Cicely Tyson, she hadn't won an Oscar at this point, but she had been nominated. And the fact that she can, you know, achieve that level of prestige and still be relegated to such a small kind of like there's not much for her to do in this movie. Mm-hmm. I don't like it.
It's bad.
In conclusion, humph. Yeah.
I think we need a reboot. Once again, she's still around. Write Sipsy she's back in. Not a reboot, yeah. but a remake. That's what it is.
A remake. Yeah. Do Sipsy justice this time.
Yeah. Okay. We haven't talked about Kathy Bates yet.
No. Yes. That's the other big thing. So with I love Kathy Bates. I do like Evelyn's character a lot. I enjoy her evolution over the course of the movie, her character arc, because she basically goes from a like polite, subservient Southern woman to like learning to be empowered and learning independence. And this is happening while she is hearing this story from Ninny. So it's like learning about, like becoming friends with Ninny and learning about Iggy and Ruth is like part of what empowers her to enact change in her own life.
Yeah. Yeah. Take charge.
Yeah.
There's just some great scenes. You know, the scene where she's imagining wearing all cellophane.
Oh. The cellophane.
To greet her husband.
I'm like, how did I not remember that shot?
Oh, yeah.
But I remembered the cannibalism of it. That was incredible.
I will say, by 2020 standards, watching a white woman freak out in a grocery store brings up a lot of Karen images.
Sure.
A new context.
I was like, is this the origin story of Karen? Like, you know, they too much Tawanda, too much Kathy Bates. No, but she's going off on other, you know, younger, hotter ladies, Karens, or Beckys, I guess.
Yeah, right. Just kind of the next generation of Karen that she's...
Yes. Yeah.
She's going up against.
But that like, you know, it's the 80s. Feminism won. And yet I still make my husband dinner every day and he grabs it and sits down in front of the TV and doesn't pay attention to me and there's no love in our relationship anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I was feeling that. You know, and she's trying. She's going to these classes. She still thinks mm-hmm. it's her. And then she just stops giving a fuck. And that's when everything's wonderful and she starts to like, yeah, I don't know. She just kind of takes charge, you know?
She's just like, this is a part of who I am and I'm going to embrace it. And yeah, I like that, like, again, the evolution of what we see where first she's taking these classes to help her with her marriage, which, of course, she, as the woman, is expected to do all the emotional labor of
right.
fixing anything about their marriage, and then he gets to just, like, sit at home and watch baseball all day. Then her friend, Missy, is like, screw this, we need to... Wait, what does she say? She's like, what we really need is an assertive training class for Southern women, but for you, Evelyn, that's a paradox, because you're living in the Dark Ages. Yeah. And mm-hmm. Evelyn's like, oh no. So then they start to go to these, I guess, these assertiveness training classes for Southern women. And these are kind of cartoony where the woman's like, okay, now take off your underwear, everyone, and look at your vagina.
I remember this scene from being a little kid. I was like, what? That's a thing?
But like, I mean, I don't know. Was that a thing? I think I mentioned this earlier. I thought that the way that the other women in that class were characterized was like kind of cartoony and not super fair.
It did feel
like
cartoony.
They were so aggro. And then I think Kathy Bates' character is supposed to be the voice of reason of like, well, I'm all for feminism, but this is a bit much. Like that is kind of.
I choose to read it as because Kathy Bates' character is so repressed that it's going to feel very cartoony and absurd to like get to know your body and to learn to be empowered at first. But then she does a 180 eventually where she's like,
she gets a tiny,
like,
trampoline.
I'm going to shoot some men. Like, yeah, I'm so glad that Frank died. I'm like, fuck all the wife beaters. Yep. Their genitals should be shot off. Like she's going on this like tirade to Ninny and Ninny's like, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah. And he's like, oh my God. She stresses Ninny out. I like that Ninny, in some of it, is like a little bit like, I feel like advice you would get from a grandma, which makes sense because that is, Ninny is a grandma. But I love that there is, I mean, their whole storyline is just like two women at different phases of aging, being comfortable with themselves. And like Ninny offers her wisdom about like, oh, have you considered like taking hormones if that is going to make your like process of going through menopause easier? Try that. And Kathy Bates is like, oh,
you're going through the change.
She's going through the change.
Oh.
And then she said something that sounded so much like my grandma, which she was just like, oh, you're unhappy with your life? Put on some makeup, get a job, eat healthier. I was like, okay, grandma. But like, but it's
your
very
hormones,
sweet and
though.
It's very well intentioned.
Mm. Dude, hormones. My mom would be a different person without hormones. Less hormones. I am not looking forward to the change. I'm going to need all the hormones I need.
But I like that there's no, the way they talk about it, there's no, even though Kathy Bates' character is like not comfortable having these conversations at first, there's not like really any stigma around it. They're just talking about it. If Kathy Bates doesn't know something, she says so, or she's like, oh, what? Yeah. And then Ninny just explains what she means. And then Kathy Bates says, oh, and like Ninny's never trying to make her feel bad about herself. Mm-hmm. And
she's so comfortable in who she is.
I love it.
That's exactly right. Like it's less an exploration. I mean, it is very gendered, but it also is just like, oh, just being comfortable with who you are and finding yourself and realizing you don't have to be the perfect wife. And it's not on you to do all that emotional labor.
Mm-hmm.
Super liberating.
I wish she dumped Ed.
Yeah.
Dude, I know.
Ed was not going to. Do you think Ed was going to improve? No way.
Mm-mm, he's not going to redeem himself.
I like when he threw the sushi.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That's my favorite scene. He's like, what the hell is this? And she's like, it's a low cholesterol meal. Happy Valentine. And then he's like, are you trying to kill me? And then she's like, if I was going to kill you, I'd use my hands. And she's like bouncing around on this little exercise trampoline. It was perfect.
I really enjoyed the guy who played her husband. I really enjoyed his performance. I had never seen him before. He's done a lot of character acting, but I mean, I thought he was
He's great.
A blast.
Yeah. He gave a great performance.
He knew exactly who he was playing.
Mm-hmm. Best line is one of the best lines. How in the hell do you hit a car 3 times on accident?
On accident.
I really like that. I mean, that scene, and that scene is like kind of a little cartoony and portrays younger women as just evil shrews that will just whip their head around and be like, deal with it, old lady, which I have never seen happen, but you know, it for her character growth, the caredness of it all is very present, but it is also kind of satisfying to watch her deliver that weird, like that smug insurance line of like,
she's like, I'm older and I've got more insurance.
Now you're being classist, Kathy Bates. But I get what they were going for. I was on board just because of how like Kathy Bates can just give the line read of a lifetime and then do something fun. And like, I'm never not going to love that.
Like when she says, I'm too young to be old and I'm too old to be young. It's so like, good. I already feel that.
I felt that so hard too. And it's weird though, because when I first watched this as a like 10-year-old, in a way, I mean, God, yes, the movie does a lot of things poorly, but representing women in their 40s and in their 80s, mm-hmm. it did a pretty good job. And it was like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's a whole stage of life, eh? Oh, marriage, not going to do that. Oops, did it. then undid it. But like, there's a lot of that that I think sticks with you from a younger age. As a young woman watching this, I think it's nice. We don't have a lot of that now.
Definitely not in the early 90s.
And not, I don't know now. Like, what are some solid, like, women in their 40s films? Like, I didn't see Steel Magnolias then, but I saw Beaches. We'll look back, definitely problematic, but 40-year-old women-centered. And I'm like, I don't know. Movies now are like, no, you're just supposed to be 28 forever.
Right.
Right.
I mean, book club.
that's women in their 70s. It's like there's older, no in between. I don't think that there's still not a lot of like, I mean, I feel like it maybe in indie movies it's more, but a lot of times it's, I think that there is, I wish I had more like receipts to back this point up, but maybe you'll both see what I'm saying. I think that there is like a lot of like, we see a lot of actresses over 40, but they're very rarely playing over 40, where they're like, wow, this is so cool. She's over 40 and working, but she's playing a 28-year-old. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, women being allowed to play roles their age is still, there's a lot to be desired.
There's a lot to be desired. And I mean, there are just hardly any roles written for women characters who are 40 and above. So the fact that like this movie focuses on two of them.
Wow. They should have focused on Cicely Tyson too, but whatever. Yes. Where not whatever. I just am hung up. I just love her. Okay. And again, this is, I feel like it proves every time we cover a movie featuring, First Wives Club is another example of like a movie that features women over 40. And these movies always do super well because people want, like older women want to see themselves represented. Like, and it, like this movie did incredibly well. And I think the other trend that is connected to getting movies made about older women is that the only way a Hollywood studio will greenlight it is if there are huge stars attached. Sure. Where movies about older guys, you can kind of have been in, like you could have played a corpse on NCIS twice and they're like, you're hired. But for these movies, like, First Wives Club is a good example. Like,
so good.
Three really incredibly popular actresses had to sign on to that movie for it to be possible. Kathy Bates and Jessica Tandy had both been nominated for Oscars in the last 2 years when this movie was greenlit. Mm-hmm. So they were, at this time especially, they were like, oh, for sure properties. People will see a movie. Like,
yeah.
And you have to imagine that if they were not kind of at the top of their game critically at this time, like it would have been a lot harder to get a movie like this made.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's definitely not enough like good substantial roles written for older women where they can talk about the, you know, where aging can be a theme and not something that is like, oh, it's a huge success if you're able to conceal the fact that you're aging versus discussing
totally.
It in
detail
the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So their relationship is really nice. I wish that you know, I mean, I don't know how this would have been financially possible. Maybe that's why she doesn't dump Ed. But she becomes a very successful Mary Kay worker, like all of my friends' moms. So where's the problem? She should have kicked Ed out and then been like, all right, Ninny, we're roommates, we're best friends. Ed is going to have to make his own dinner from now on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ending we needed.
That happens. Yeah. I like to imagine that happens.
Yeah.
That's my headcanon.
The last thing I want to say is, I think we would be remiss not to mention Ninny's horrible purple hair dye job that she gets from...
Okay, judgy.
That was very judgy, but it's objectively...
living to the fullest.
She likes it, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
The other thing...
I did cackle when that happened, because you just, like, don't see that coming, and then it's not super relevant to the plot, no. So you're just kind of like...
like... Well, I think it's part of it is, like... showing that Evelyn is still abiding by these like this like Southern politeness mentality of like, oh, this is awful, but I can't say anything because I'm too polite. But also like she's not going to be like, your hair looks like shit, Ninny, because it like I don't think anyone would say that.
I work for Mary Kay now. Fix your face, Ninny.
Deal with it. This is also high visibility for makeup products at home, like this stretch of years, because we have Edward Scissorhands, Avon Lady.
Yeah.
And then a year later, Mary Kay throws their hat in the mix, uh-huh. And they're like, no, guess Avon who? Anyways, they're both MLMs, so whoopsies.
Well, as we hinted at a lot, the movie definitely does pass the Bechdel test. It is passing between Evelyn and Ninny tons. It passes between Ruth and Iggy tons.
Almost every... I feel like outside of discussing the murder or Ed, men do not come up that much. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
Right.
Which is great. I love that, mm-hmm. for this movie.
Unfortunately, though, if we're applying like the Vito Russo test to it, it does not pass because the characters are not identifiably queer. That's one of the contingencies of that test.
It certainly does not pass the DuVernay test, right. Because black characters are just not allowed to be full characters.
Right. They are only there to serve the white characters.
So with that in mind, mm-hmm. Let's go to the nipple scale.
Yes. So 0 to 5 nipples. Examining the movie through an intersectional feminist lens. Mm. I would give this movie, I think, 3. I would have gotten higher had it not mishandled the representation of the black characters and sidelined them and failed to give them any kind of interiority or deeper characterization. I think it would have gotten more had... the character's been allowed to be identifiably queer, and let us see some actual kissing. Let's see them embrace. Let's see them be romantic with each other.
Keep the food fight, but give us a kissing scene.
Let the food fight turn into a steamy sex scene.
Don't start. Okay.
But I do really like the character, the female characters that we get to know. Love Kathy Bates. Love the Ninny character. I love Ruth and Iggy and their relationship. Would have liked to seen more Sipsy, of course. Also, we didn't talk about this character, but there's a character named Smokey who seems to be a person experiencing homelessness. He's characterized as like a depression era, like drifter type. And while he doesn't play an enormous role in the story, I appreciated that some work was put into humanizing a person experiencing homelessness, because so little media does that.
Yeah.
There's a lot to love about this movie, but it is very much of the 1991
Oscar bait
frame of mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the Oscar bait, I feel like a lot of the choices this movie makes, I feel like directly ties to the Oscar bait element of like, if the Academy is going to think that we've gone quote unquote too far, then what's the point of making it? Which is right. Like, it's like that to this day.
But it's also like, I probably just edgy enough for 91 that it's like, but like, we're doing something. We're making statements here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are a few lightweight statements being made for sure.
Yeah, but we look back on it almost 30 years later and we're like, well, yep, that was 30 years ago. That's where we were.
Yeah.
So yeah, 3 nipples. I'll give 2 to Sipsy, and I'll give my remaining nipple to Kathy Bates. Ooh.
I'll go with three as well for this movie. I think, you know, for its time, it's doing a lot of things that a lot of movies aren't doing, where, I mean, I do think it's like a huge deal that a queer writer was given authorship over her own mm-hmm. work in a film adaptation, and that there were like resources put behind it. I think Norman Lear's production company was involved, which famously very progressive, like wonderful person. So that's great. But I do agree. I mean, I think that it's like pretty clear that white people are the creative force behind this movie because of what it gets wrong or what it erases, or and they Cicely Tyson, and then they don't use her, and they don't even show her the biggest moment for the character for like suspense. That doesn't, who cares about the murder mystery really? Like, that's not really why we're here. Like you were saying, I want an actual queer relationship. I like, it's so frustrating to know that like the actors playing these characters were like thinking that, and were, this was informing their character, but the finished product is not allowed to show mm-hmm. that. So that's frustrating. But I really enjoyed this movie. It made me cry a lot. You never see women talk about aging on screen. You don't usually see a lot of intergenerational friendships. I always think that that's really nice. And it was done in this like really lovely, not condescending mm-hmm. way.
You also get, there's not much body diversity, but with Kathy Bates, you know, she talks about kind of her insecurities with her size, and is it handled the way we would want to see exactly? Perhaps not, but the fact that
the language is very 91.
She does a bit of fat shaming of herself, which is something I've done a lot throughout my entire life. She also has a line at some point where she says something like, I just wish I had the courage to get really fat, which is another thought I've had quite a bit. So, you know, I guess I just found her attitude toward her body to be very relatable. And then part of her evolution is like, well, I'm going to start exercising. I have to change the way I look. And then she refers to her like former self as a blob from a horror movie. So like,
which I don't love. I do think that at very least it's framed that she is like doing the exercise stuff for herself mm-hmm. and not for her husband, which is, I don't like the language she uses around it, but I did appreciate that they made it pretty clear that she was making these changes for herself, and she was like happier
for sure
for having made these changes for herself. Yes. So in that way, I was like, good for Kathy Bates.
Yes.
This movie is lovely. And I mean, when Ruth died, I was so invested in that relationship. And when Ruth dies, I just cried so much.
I know.
So I'm going to give three nipples as well. I'm going to give one nipple to Cicely Tyson. I'm going to give one. I love Mary Louise Parker mm-hmm. so much. I'm going to give her the other two.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to know what Mary Louise Parker has to say about the film. She's the one person I don't think we have heard from.
Yeah, I wonder.
Let's call her.
Yeah, give her a little ringy poo.
Come over.
Francesca, what about your nipple rating? What do you think?
I'm going to give it four nipples, but only because I am new to this and it is very much stuck in time. It is stuck in 91 interpreting the 30s, and it is mm-hmm. Oscar bait. And I don't expect all movies to be all things to all people. It is very problematic in a lot of ways. But I think you got four very strong and very different female characters. Evelyn, Ninny, Iggy, but maybe they're the three, maybe they're the same, and Ruth. Mm. And they're excellent. Yeah, would have loved more Sipsy, but you got four strong female characters with backstories, with interesting lives, with all these things. You get four. They have a bunch of conversations that don't involve men. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And make me cry three times, four times, however many times. Needed to be more nipples. If they had actual nipples, you'd get the five.
If we had seen some steamy sex scenes.
Yes.
Yeah. Really boosted that.
Okay, so Francesca, because you asked, I was like, has Mary Louise Parker said anything about this? She did say something about it in 2008. So this was on Ellen 12 years before she was handily canceled. But anyways, Mary Louise Parker goes on Ellen. Ellen asks her about this movie. Mary Louise Parker says, you know, I love my lesbian fans. And then she talks about something that is not so so we know that. And then she goes on to say later in the interview that or the after Ellen interviewer, I don't know who was doing interview, whatever. Do you ever wish the storyline on Fried Green Tomatoes was a little bit more? Mary Louise Parker says, yes. Well, in some ways I do. I tried to make it a bit more articulated at the time, but they didn't want to go that way. And in many ways, I wish it was. Then in some ways, I think maybe the audience wouldn't have gone there. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it because I really tried to push it at the time and they didn't want to go there with me. Wow. And then after Ellen asks, who didn't want to go there? And Mary Louise Parker says, no one. And then after Ellen says, not even your co-star? And Mary Louise Parker says, oh, no, Mary Stewart definitely did and Fanny Flagg did, but not the director, not the producer, nobody else. But I was really trying to push it and they were like, no.
So none of the men.
None of the men who get the final say on this project about women. So we know that the three main, you know, women involved in this storyline really wanted it and they said no. So maybe Fanny Flagg was being diplomatic in those interviews with those quotes.
Maybe
we should ask her.
Let's call her too. Well, director John Avnet famously said about this movie and his approach to the relationship between those two women, he says, quote, I had no interest in going into the bedroom. And it's like, ew.
Then get out of the movie, stinky.
You can have sex in the kitchen.
As you said. Yeah. So that's the movie. Francesca, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for letting me talk so much about this film.
Where can people check out your stuff online, follow your social media, etc.?
At Franny Fio on all the things, Twitter, Instagram, and the Bituation Room podcast.
Yes. Listen to that, please. Oh, yeah.
Listen,
great.
Find that. And thank you guys.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you for being here.
You can follow us on social media at Bechdelcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can check out our Patreon, aka Matreon. It's $5 a month. It gets you 2 bonus episodes every single month. What a bargain.
Ugh.
And you get access to the entire back catalog of our bonus episodes, which is now over 70 of them.
You love to hear it. You can get our merch over on tpublic.com/thebechdelcast. You can get a mask now. Pretty fun, pretty cool. And we love you so much.
Yes.
Talk to you next week.
To Wanda.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.